Hello, everyone. Dr. Mackenzie Brooks here. Welcome to Women's Work of Quickening. This is what women do. All over our planet, incredible women are engaged in all kinds of life-essential, life-respecting, life-supporting, and life-enhancing actions. We at drmackenziebrooks.com are collecting their stories, compiling them in one location for women to access, to listen, and perhaps to be inspired by the inner and outer journeys that these women of voice and action are walking. Every story shared by these women of voice and action offer the rest of us an opportunity to learn and benefit from the life learnings and wisdoms that these women have gained on their heroic journeys and now are willing to share with us. My deepest desire is that you enjoy listening to this inspiring woman as much as I have enjoyed engaging in this interview conversation with her. Today is December 17, 2015, and we are joined by Dr. Ellen Moyer. Dr. Moyer lives in the state of Massachusetts in the United States of America. Ellen Moyer is a writer, speaker, engineer, and environmental advocate whose mission is to help restore the environment and promote a healthier way for us to inhabit the earth. Even as an 8-year-old picking up litter by the side of her road for 5 cents a bag, Ellen was intensely aware of the beauty of the natural world and how our way of life threatens it. A generalist with a big picture view, she has studied people in other times and places who have lived sustainably or not, researching their food production, ecology, and social and cultural practices. As an environmental engineer with 30 years of experience, Ellen works on cleanup projects for private and public clients to restore sites contaminated by a wide array of harmful chemicals. She also practices in other areas of environmental engineering, including pollution prevention, sustainability, engineering economics, and environmental impact analysis. With a BA in anthropology, an MS in Environmental Engineering, and a PhD in Civil Engineering, Ellen is a registered professional engineer and a U.S. Green Building Council LEED accredited professional. After working for several consulting firms, she established her own practice, Green Environment LLC, in 2004. Outside of her work, Ellen is an artist who has exhibited and sold paintings, photographs and fabric designs, an enthusiastic gardener, and a health and fitness enthusiast. She serves on town committees, supports environmental nonprofit organizations, and works with citizens to protect forests from irresponsible logging. Her work protecting forests propelled her into writing and speaking. Ellen is a regular contributor to the Huffington Post and has authored 2 books. Her upcoming 3rd book, Let's Evolve, How to Have Fun Creating a Sustainable World, describes how our current environmental, health, and economic crisis provide a grand opportunity for humans to evolve to the next level. She proposes that if we seize this chance, humans, the environment, and the economy will all thrive. She also believes we may even enjoy the process of creating a sustainable world. Please visit her website at www.ellenmoyerphd.com and check out her blogs at www.huffingtonpost.com/Ellen-Moyer-PhD/. Hello, Ellen. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Ellen, please tell us how you found yourself doing what you're doing.
These days I'm doing environmental consulting. I went out on my own 11 years ago, and I work for public and private clients, working mainly on cleaning up contamination, especially contaminated groundwater, but I also do some more proactive work protecting resources. I'm also a regular contributor to the Huffington Post, so I'm enjoying writing articles about sustainability and environmental issues there. And I'm also working on a book about how to have fun creating a sustainable world. So that's what I'm up to. And how did I get there? Well, you probably don't want to hear my whole life story, but I basically grew up very close to nature. I lived on a river road and next to a floodplain, and there was a lot of wildlife around, and my parents were avid nature lovers. We had a lot of pets and did gardening, and in the summer we lived in a tent all summer long at our summer place. But juxtaposed with all that was a lot of human impact. People would dump refrigerators and stoves and whatever they didn't want into the floodplain right next to the river. They'd litter all over the place. My mother would be telling us about how to identify birds, but the hunters would be out there shooting the wildlife. So it was just a kind of a crazy juxtaposition of beautiful nature and then the human impact. So I guess from all that, I just really wanted to reduce our human impact. Another thing that entered into that was I had a Welsh pony for several years and used to go riding every day almost on this beautiful land. And the town we lived in took that land and used it to construct a landfill for the town's municipal solid waste. And they made a really fantastic landfill. You know, it was lined, it had a fantastic recycling system and everything. It was beautiful. But nevertheless, they took this beautiful land and turned it into a place for us to throw our waste. So that just propelled me into a career of working on environmental issues. And I was mostly working quietly at environmental consulting firms, you know, contributing to helping clean up sites and not making a lot of waves or anything. But then about 10 years ago, there were several large wood-burning power plants proposed in our state of Massachusetts. And one of them was proposed to be built in the town next to my town. And as I looked into this, I saw how ridiculous and damaging these facilities would be. But the state regulators were not recognizing the dangers, and they were green-lighting these projects. And so a lot of people started fighting against these projects, including me. And in the course of working on this, I became fairly vocal, both in writing and in speaking. I thought that once I pointed out the folly of these projects, that of course they would see the light and they would say, oh, of course, silly me, I should not have let this be proposed. But that is not what happened. In spite of the glaring problems with these plants, people had to fight for years to make them go away, like 7-8 years. So in the course of these battles, it was necessary to write letters to regulators, comments on submittals from the developers, and also I wrote a lot of letters to the editor. And it was also necessary to speak at public hearings, at State House, delivering testimony. So kind of in the course of these biomass wars, as I call them, I became more visible and was more working not behind the scenes but trying to make change. And I'll just mention one more thing in the answer to, you know, why, how did you end up doing what you're doing? I really didn't like working on these individual projects and going to public hearings. I don't have the patience for it. I'm not cut out for it. I also realized that how much energy it takes to fight these projects one at a time or a couple at a time. And so it really motivated me to do the air war instead of the ground war. So I decided, hey, I'm going to write a book on how we need to change our system here because it's not working. And so that's my main project these days, is working on this book. And Huffington Post blogs are related to my book project and help me get the word out of the things I'm working on. So I guess that's a capsule summary of how I found myself doing what I'm doing.
This is your third book. Could you share a little bit about your first two books?
Sure. Now, this book I'm working on now is for a non-technical audience. The first two books were technical. The first was actually my master's thesis, and it was about evaluating the economic costs and benefits of looking for and fixing leaks in water distribution systems. So it was mainly trying to figure out, is this water conservation method worthwhile? And it was. And I submitted my thesis to the American Water Works Association, and they published it. The second book was actually for a client. I've done a lot of work on gasoline contamination, and especially the gasoline additive called MTBE, which stands for methyl tertiary butyl ether. And my client, who was the largest manufacturer of MTBE, hired me to edit a 650-page handbook on how to assess and remediate MTBE once it's released into soil and groundwater. So I conceived of the outline and the structure of the book. I found authors for all of the material. We had over 50 authors, and I advised on how I wanted each of the chapters structured, and I edited everything. It's a coordinated book. It's not like an anthology or something like that. So that was my second book, all on billable hours. Boy, do I wish I could do this book now on billable hours, but that was really fun. I loved doing it, and a lot of work came my way once that book was out. I still refer to it all the time, and other people do too. I just really got into it. So that's what that one's about.
Ellen, do you want to share a little bit about the book that's coming out in the near future?
It's mainly about how we can create a sustainable world, and it's much easier to do than we think. You know, we all run around, we're so overwhelmed and frazzled and all that, and we need to cut through that and realize that everything is interconnected, and if we replace a couple of bad things with a couple of good things, it's going to make a gigantic difference. And we'll also be a lot happier and healthier if we go ahead and create a sustainable world. One analogy I like to use is in medieval times, people used to throw their waste into the street, right? They'd throw really nasty stuff in the street. You know, it was putrid, it was miserable, but not only that, it attracted rats and fleas and the bubonic plague, and so, you know, people got very sick from it. And eventually people made the connection and said, hey, we need to stop throwing stuff in the street. And once they did that, life got better. The cities that had been plague-ridden started to flourish and still flourish to this day. I think if we stop spewing carbon into the atmosphere and stop throwing our waste around and instead create a way that doesn't involve waste, where we recycle everything as in nature, we're going to like it a heck of a lot more than what we have now. I'm trying to inspire people that there's a lot of hope for a better world and we can do it, guides how to work on ourselves and our institutions and policies so we can get there. We hear a lot of gloom and doom scenarios. I'm presenting an alternative, which is a hopeful and constructive scenario.
Ellen, when will that book be available for purchase?
My hope it'll be ready in a year. I've been going the traditional publisher route, but I think I'm going to self-publish, and that will speed up the process. So I would hope, you know, within the year.
So anyone interested in purchasing your book, Ellen, can go to your website, ellenmoyerphd.com.
Yeah, I would love it if people would join my email list. I send links to my occasional Huffington Post articles when they come out. I send those to the list, and then when my book is available, I'll send a notice also. That would be fantastic. Well, people can just email me, and I'll keep track. But the easiest way for everybody is to just join my email list.
So, Ellen, what impact has taking action had on your life?
Well, it's launched me into this whole writing speaking mode, as I described. So that's one thing. It's really changed me in a lot of ways. One is I realized that I can make a difference. It is true that individuals can really make a difference, even if they don't think they can. For example, I'll just tell you a little factoid that was kind of interesting. The developers of one of these biomass plants had submitted an environmental notification form. And that's a brief form saying, hey, we're going to want to do this project, and here's what it's about. And then the regulators will come back and say, okay, study this, that, this, that, this, that. So in their little summary, they're saying what they're going to do. And I'm commenting on it because the public has the opportunity to comment on all these types of submittals. So I'm taking a break from writing my comments. I go out to get the mail, and I see a newsletter from MassPIRG. That's Massachusetts Public Interest Research Group, in my mailbox. So I'm just kind of flipping through it as I'm walking back to the house. And it has an article in there about the 10 worst carbon dioxide emitting power plants in the Northeast. And it listed how much carbon dioxide they emit and how much power they provide. And I thought, oh, wouldn't it be interesting to see what this proposed biomass plant does in terms of CO2 per unit of energy. It'd be interesting to compare it. So I took the numbers from the developer's submittal and just did the division to calculate the carbon dioxide emitted per unit of energy, and I was flabbergasted to see that it would emit more carbon dioxide than the worst power plant in the whole Northeast United States. So I kind of stumbled into that, and me and a lot of others made a big deal of this because the proposed biomass plants were going to get a lot of subsidies from the public based on the presumption that they're clean and green. But this shows that they're not clean and green. They emit about 1.5 times as much carbon dioxide as coal. So that one thing changed the whole course of events. And ultimately, citizens forced the state regulators to change their regulations to take out some of the corporate pork because the rationale was not there. This is not clean and green, so you shouldn't be giving money to these facilities on the basis that they're clean and green. So that made a big difference, and that was just an example of one person commenting on a submittal from a developer. So that was just an example of how a person can make a difference. I also, you asked what impact has taking action had on your life. I find that when I take action, I feel much more optimistic. It's easy to get discouraged if you're just sitting there and not doing something to help. But when you help, you just feel better. So that's a big plus. And I also just met a lot of people taking action on this issue and other issues, and it's very encouraging and inspiring, you know, to think of all the good things people are doing out there. So, you know, I made some good friends at it, and I've stayed in touch with people and inspired by so many people out there doing incredible things. I guess another thing that taking action did to me is I realized that people do have the ultimate power. You know, we often walk around and say, oh, corporate has it all sewn up and the system is corrupted and things are going to hell. But in a democracy like in the U.S. or Canada, people still have the right to vote, or at least most people do, and that power trumps any other power. So that is a very good thing to keep in mind. So I guess those are some of the impacts.
Ellen, earlier you were speaking about you made a decision to move into what you called air war as compared to ground war. Would you be willing to talk a little bit about what your thoughts are when you use those phrases, just so our listeners can understand that?
By that I meant, on the ground war, I was referring to working on specific projects and, for example, going to all the public hearings about a proposed biomass plant, getting signatures for a ballot initiative to try to force change. Those are the kinds of activities I meant by the ground war. By the air war, I meant more using words and language. For example, in books or Huffington Post articles or talks. I do like to give talks on sustainability and climate change and environmental issues. So more trying to educate in general rather than focusing on specific proposed projects.
As a woman, Ellen, what have you learned?
Well, I've learned that our system really is quite messed up. Before this all happened, the biomass plants, I thought we had a pretty good system, and yeah, it's a little clunky and not as fast as we'd like, but I realized that the environmental laws that were passed, especially in the 1970s, and the institutions that were set up, environmental institutions set up around that time to implement the environmental laws, they've really become corrupted is probably too strong a word, but they've become weakened over time as there's been lobbying by special interests to loosen protections. So at the same time I've learned our system is pretty messed up, I've also learned that we can fix it much more easily than we may think. And that's evidenced by the fact that the people I was working with to fight these biomass plants, we actually did get the regulations changed in our state and changed so significantly that none of those proposed projects has broken ground. We took away a lot of their corporate pork and they can't make it without it. Now there's one that is going to try to make it without the subsidies, so we'll see what happens. The power of ordinary citizens is just remarkable. Another thing I learned is just how much resistance there is to change and new information. I mentioned that I thought the regulators would see the errors of their ways quickly and change course, but that would not happen. So some ideas just become entrenched, and it's very hard to shake them loose. But also, you know, I learned the power of words and the power of vote and the power of information. And those things are greater than the power of money, which is also formidable, but not as formidable as words and votes. So it really was very educational to go through this process.
What are women's strengths and wisdoms, Ellen?
I feel like it's dangerous to generalize about, like, intrinsic strengths and wisdoms, like things that we're born with or that are innate. But I do realize that men and women are trained differently in our current Western society. So they do turn out somewhat differently. But there's so many exceptions and there's so much variety, it's still dangerous. But with all those caveats, I'd say that women have been trained to care about and care for others and to put their own needs second. So I would say women's strengths and wisdom include the ability to really look out for the interests of others and to have perhaps more compassion. And, you know, another thing which is related to intrinsic characteristics would be, you know, women can't usually win on physical strength. That's just the reality. So I think there's a tendency for women to use their intelligence more since, you know, they can't just beat someone to a pulp to win the fight. But, oh, with all the 7 billion people out there, you know, I think there's just so much variety that I would be reluctant to generalize any further than what I just said.
Based on your life learnings to date, what do you invite other women to know from what you've learned?
Well, you know, ordinary people have the power to insist on environmental and human health, at least in democratic societies. And as I keep harping on, changing the world is easier than we think because of the ways everything is interconnected. So we really need to muster the will, really, to insist on changing things for the better. And for us to have the will, it's really, that's going to happen. We're going to have the will if we care enough. I don't mean to sound judgmental, but if we don't care enough to fix the climate, we're just going to let things spiral out of control. So it really does come down to caring and figuring out what our priorities are. I would also like to say that people who are free to act should act. You and I live in free societies where we can speak out and not be killed or thrown in jail. But that is not the case in many places. There are a lot of environmental activists who are murdered in other countries for speaking out. So they just demonstrate so much courage and sacrifice. And I just feel like we almost have a responsibility to speak out because we can speak out and because others cannot, and we need to speak out partly for them because they were killed or otherwise silenced. Another thing I would invite other women to know is that we should just absolutely reject any suggestion of second-class status. That is totally unacceptable. Even the subtle stealth type things we should just refuse to participate in. A lot of good stuff out there is happening, and there is a lot of hope. So we need to cut down on the amount of traditional media that we consume because it's quite negative and biased in the negative direction. So to keep up to speed on what's going on, but to put network news especially into perspective and not consume that kind of news like when you're eating, for example. So it needs to be put in its place so that we don't lose hope and become too discouraged.
What keeps you going, Ellen?
Well, I like doing so many things. I really enjoy just about everything. I mean, even vacuuming the house is fun, you know? So I just have fun at everything. The main thing that really motivates me, though, is love of nature and just affinity with nature. I love plants and animals and, you know, get a lot of joy from, like, feeding animals or seeing that they have clean water and nice habitat, good places to have their nests. I just love them. So that's really what keeps me going. And also really wanting to reduce our human footprint here.
How can other women help?
Well, everybody, just by their daily actions, makes a big difference. Whether they know it or not, whether they like it or not, just by the way people go grocery shopping, they're either helping or hurting. If they're buying industrial food, then they are killing monarch butterflies, birds, frogs, other wildlife that suffer from pesticides and herbicides. They're supporting big agricultural companies at the expense of small farmers. They're creating dead zones in the oceans, for example, at the mouth of the Mississippi River, where there's an area the size of New Jersey with no oxygen and no life in the water. I don't mean to lay a guilt trip on, but the reality is, if you're going to engage in industrial food, that's the effect you're having. If you're going to buy organic food, you're helping build up the soil instead of letting it erode away. You're not poisoning everything with herbicides and pesticides or creating dead zones. You're supporting, in many cases, smaller, more local farms. That's not universal, but there's more of that. So, and you're also promoting health and reducing healthcare costs because you're not consuming neurotoxic pesticides that give people cancer and all kinds of other problems. So each person is making a difference. So what people can do to help is to become aware of the consequences of their actions and choose better actions. You asked about how other women can help. I think it's the same for men and women. You know, everybody just needs to keep pushing and not sit back or become complacent or overwhelmed. And people have different ways of contributing and different gifts, different talents, different things they like to do. And we need a whole bunch of things happening. So if people just keep trying, that's fantastic. And specific to women, though, you ask, how can other women help? One thing they can do is take charge of their own lives and refuse to behave like doormats. I see too many women who are only serving others and negating their own needs and wants, and I think that's a mistake. And it doesn't help the world, and it's a horrible role model for the next generations of women. So we need to just put a stop to that kind of behavior. And, you know, there are a lot of little things people can do. For example, I've started this thing. It's called Ellen's List. It's for quickly and efficiently signing environmental petitions. So in a couple of minutes per week, someone can go on to my site there, pick and choose the petitions they want to sign, and sign them. And believe it or not, these petitions can make a huge difference. There's amazing stories of what petitions have done. So just taking little actions like that can really make a big difference. And you multiply that by a lot of people, and you're talking some real heft. So I think it's a lot in the little things, really. where people can help. It's easy to say, well, I'm going to wait until I have a whole week to work on this or that. Or I think it's better to just kind of nick away at things and try to do good things in your daily life and help when you can and just kind of be consistent, because all those little actions over time really add up. And but speaking of Ellenquist, shoot me an email if you'd like to join, or just go to, I didn't give you this one for the bio, Mackenzie, and I should have. Just go to ellenslist.org and you can sign up very easily. The whole point is to save people time. So it's ellenslist.org. So that's a cool thing people can do. So, and just don't get discouraged. That's really key to being able to help, is to not being depressed. And it's easy to get depressed because you can find plenty of things to justify that attitude. But just positive and just persevering every day, trying to do a little here, a little there.
Could you share with us a few examples of when petitions have resulted in change?
Oh, yeah. If you don't mind me clicking a bit to pull something up on my computer here, because I actually have a folder full of success stories. Petitions got this company, the second largest popcorn company, to pledge to phase out bee-killing pesticides, the neonicotinoid pesticides. And similarly, yes, so that's one. Subway announced that it's going to phase out antibiotics from its entire meat supply. And part of, this was announced 2 days before this organization was going to deliver petition signatures of more than 110,000 supporters of that. Here's one. Costco, the second largest retailer in the world, just committed to not sell GMO salmon. And this email from Friends of the Earth says, this progress would not have been possible without people like you taking actions. You signed petitions, sent emails, made phone calls, and delivered letters to your local store, and it paid off. So often it's not only petitions that do it, but, you know, a bunch of actions. But petitions are right up there. And I have heard of petitions getting this redneck guy off of a talk show or from having a talk show. I can't remember his name, and I didn't keep that email. But, okay, Nestle does a lot of bottled water. And they were after some water in Oregon, and they got 250,000 people from around the world to petition to the state regulators. And as a result, Governor Kate Brown of Oregon announced that she's putting the Nestle deal under public review. So there, apparently there was a review, or there was a deal where Nestle was going to get all this water, and people said, oh, no, you don't. And so the governor's saying, oh, you better look at this. So I don't know the result of that yet. That was just a month ago. PepsiCo, they have been doing a lot of palm oil operations in Indonesia, which is horrible for the forest. And PepsiCo just came out with a new palm oil policy committing to uphold the rights of local communities and workers. Now, they say here it still contains loopholes, so the pressure is continuing. But at least they got this started. This is another email from Friends of the Earth where they're saying to petition President Obama to shine a light on the campaign contributions from big oil. And the reason this is interesting is because it says by getting 100,000 signatures through the White House's We the People website. When that happens, the White House is obligated to respond. So this is trying to get 100,000 people to weigh in on that one. My brother Fred Moyer sent me an email with several successes. Here, this is from last year, General Mills announced it will set targets to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. And that was after over 100,000 people signed a petition. Lowe's, you know, I don't know if you have that in Canada, but it's a big home product chain. But they are going to, it says here, following letters and petitions from environmental groups, Lowe's Home Improvement said it plans to phase out products that contain certain chemicals shown to be harmful to bees. Let's do one more. Okay. The American Chemistry Council is going to, they're going to work on the issue of plastic in the ocean as a result of 70,000 signatures from Ocean Conservancy. And here's a quote from their official response, the American Chemistry Council, quote, "Your staff recently delivered a petition with nearly 70,000 signatures from your members urging ACC to work with Ocean Conservancy and others to keep plastic from reaching the ocean. The large number of signatures underscores for us how many people are committed to keeping plastic out of the ocean and who would want to know that we are committed to doing something about it. Please tell your members that ACC has heard them and that we're committed to being part of the solution." So I think those examples give a pretty good indication that people feel the pressure when large numbers of people do something. And I'll just say one more thing about this website. What it tries to do is make it so people can take these little actions with the petitions much more quickly. And so I consolidate all the petitions that I think are worth signing onto a list. And then each week I email people that petitions are ready to sign. So they go in and they just quickly pick the ones they want and the system autofills their information. And often I suggest that people use another email address for this purpose because you know that once you sign a petition, you get a lot of emails back, right? So if you want to avoid that clutter in your inbox, you can just use another email address that you set up for this where you never checked the inbox. So you're never bothered by a lot of emails. So you can just get my one email a week that says, hey, it's time to go sign, and that's all you have to deal with. In my weekly emails also, I summarize the good news that I've heard this week so that people don't just see all the negative stuff, you know, that petitions are about. So I talk about petition wins and things that happened. So people like it. And actually, I didn't develop it. My brother developed it for me. Fred Moyer, he's a musician and also a computer whiz. And he had been inundated with all these petitions, and he said, Ellen, I don't know what to sign, what not to sign. Can you just forward me the ones I should sign? So I started doing that. And then he said, I think I can make this into an efficient system. So he and his team created this thing. So I have to give him credit. He created this whole thing. But if you go to ellenswiss.org, there's a little video, about 3-4 minutes, that tells you exactly how to get started. It's very easy.
Is there anything else that you would like to add, Ellen?
Well, I'd love for people to join my email list, as I mentioned, and or visit my website, EllenMoyerPhD.com. Just, you know, we can't give up, so never give up. We can do whatever we want here. We can create whatever we want. So it's an amazing opportunity. And living in a free society, you know, we're so blessed. It's just incredible. So I guess that's all I would add.
I'd like to thank you, Ellen, for taking time from, it's obvious, a very busy schedule that you have, and for you to take this time and share your life learnings and your wisdom with us today.
Oh, well, thanks for inviting me and for your great questions, and I really appreciate the opportunity to spout off. Keep up the good work on your end. I know you're doing amazing things, so it's very helpful and useful.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us. Goodbye for now.